Welcome to the Country Chapel Podcast, a show dedicated to bringing lessons in rural ministry to the Calvary Global Network. Within this show, I will be interviewing pastors, church planters, ministry leaders, and various rural network directors, all who have answered the call to minister in small and often overlooked places. The aim is to gain wisdom, guidance, and vision to help encourage and equip those already engaged in rural ministry and to make the need for a focus on rural ministry obvious to all. I am Pastor Jack Coltis, and thank you for joining me. All right, guys. Well, hey, thank you so much for coming and joining me in this conversation here. And I'm really excited today because I have David Pinkney with me from Acts 29, and he is the one kind of leading up a lot of their rural ministry initiative. So, David, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and kind of tell the people a little bit about you, testimony, family, education, and past, and, you know, kind of presently where the Lord has you.
Sure thing. Thanks, Jack, for having me on. And I love to talk about rural ministry because I grew up in that setting. My dad was called out of the business world into rural pastoring. He was older. He went to college when he was 40. I was born while he was in college. So for those of you guys in your early 40s, it's just never too late to have a kid. and we moved to New Hampshire. My dad was really originally from New York State. And I've grown up in that environment. So running around, catching frogs and all the, you know, playing in the rivers and just being a rural kid, that was my upbringing, and really knew nothing other than that. As far as how, so early on in that context, I came to Jesus, or Jesus came to me. I mean, I really amazed that as a little boy, Jesus would weigh down my heart about my sin, but give me the faith to believe that He is the answer to sin and life and death and all that. And so He came to me young, at the age of around 14. I seriously started tracking with Jesus, like on a regular basis. Up to that point, I was just a good church boy believing Jesus, but not like owning it myself. So I think that was pretty natural. The fight with sin and all that stuff just became normative. Went off to college when I was 18. I loved Jesus, but I didn't like the church. Not because my dad was my hero, but like I was grew up in these Baptist churches, little rural Baptist churches that worship Jesus on Sunday, but then fought like, you know, fought like the enemies at business meetings. Anyway, I went off to college, thought I would follow Jesus, but not be a part of the church. Like somehow parachurch ministry seemed to be like the God's plan B. And then in that process, I ended up being an RA in a dorm, and the guys kept, it was a Christian school in the Christian college, and the guys kept saying, you make a good pastor. And I was trying to be obedient and say, okay, if Lord, if that's what you wanted. So I sort of changed my career trajectory in that direction, said, Lord, if you don't want me to pursue that, then stop me. And here I am. Well, that would have been 40 years ago. So here I am. Met my wife in college at Liberty University, came back to New Hampshire to start seminary, excuse me, and was looking to go somewhere outside of New England, but ended up doing seminary work here. At the same time, my dad retired, and the Little Baptist Church, rather than a Little Village Baptist Church, rather than going on a search for a pastor, knew I was studying, and I grew up, I'd spent 12 years in that church. And so they approached me. I was almost 24 years old about being the next pastor, and was there for 10 years. And the pivotal point there was what we would call today revitalizing a church, but taking the church from being inward focused to outward focused. And so that's a whole nother conversation. It worked, but about killed me. And the church blew up as far as in a good way, like we were packing out the place. That was after a lot of people left because they thought I was somehow a heretic. And and then I went on staff at a large mega church down in York County, Pennsylvania, church of about 1,200. I was the number two guy, did two-fifths of the preaching and led the young adult ministry. It was through that young adult ministry, I was there for 5 years, that I started going to Leadership Network's Young Leaders conferences. And that's where I met one of the founders of Acts 29. Acts 29 was really founded by a guy by the name of Presbyterian, by the name of David Nichols, out of Spanish River Presbyterian Church. But the young guy that he took under his wing was Mark Driscoll. And so in that setting, I got to know him. And so when God called us back to New Hampshire to plant in 2002, I needed a family that I felt was theologically sharp, missionally focused and could be a safe place for relationship. And Acts 29 was young then. In fact, our church, River Grace Church in Concord, was church number 24 to join the network. We were like early adapters to that. But in that setting, I sort of lied. And I was planning a church in Concord, New Hampshire, which is the capital of a rural state, but the capital is like a city, you know, it's a little city. And so I didn't even think of rural at that point. I just wanted to be part of this network. They were thinking about cities. They weren't talking about rural. And so I just said, yeah, we're in the urban center of New Hampshire, which is just a joke. Mm-hmm. That's how I got engaged in Acts 29. And it's just been for me part of my brotherhood and sanity and keeping me missionally focused. Fast forward to 2018. So we planted in 2002. 2018, I was asked to come on as to help lead a rural initiative. And the leadership at that point realized that Acts 29 was primarily city, upscale urban or urban hipster, suburban. We were doing nothing in two areas, among the urban poor and among rural villages. When I say we're doing nothing, what I meant by that, there was like no conversation about how to encourage planting in those settings. And so that was 5 years ago. I would say in 5 years, we've won. And what I mean by that is, while we're a small network, maybe globally, 700, 800 churches, in all of our regions, rural planting is now normal. If a guy's called to a rural plant, there's not like people raising an eyebrow going, why would you do that? It's normative. Our assessment process takes into account rural guys. And so I would say that we've won. By that, I mean, our network is now fully embraces, dignifies rural planters. And I say that also in the context that my role has sort of changed. I'm the North Atlantic Regional Director. So I'm helping our network from Maine all the way down to Virginia. In that grouping, there's probably, I'm going to guess, around 80 churches, church plants. And so my role has expanded, which includes places like New York City, Baltimore, D.C., Philadelphia, Boston. So part of my influence is trying to lead in those places as well. But my heart is always towards small places. And so that's a little bit about my story. Married to Sharon in 1988. We have raised 5 children. Now they're all adults, tracking with Jesus. We don't have any grandkids yet, but looking forward to that someday. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit. And here, one last thing, I can talk too much. 2022, we transitioned out of the leadership of River Grace Church. I'm still a member there. I'm still an elder there, but we now have a young lead pastor who's 36 years old. In fact, tonight I'll be at an elders meeting. There'll be 5 of us there. 4 of them are in their 30s, and I'm the 60-year-old. And that's a real joy as a church. After 20 years, it's a real joy for me to be part of a thriving church you planted, be a part of the leadership, but doing the good job of keeping my mouth shut and letting the young guys, you know, lead the way. And it's so anyway, that's where I'm at presently. And I work full time for Acts 29, wearing several hats, but primarily as a regional director.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's really cool. And I really appreciate you kind of just talking about the culture changes that kind of took place in Acts 29 there. I mean, you know, for lots of guys in my, you know, kind of age demographic, especially pastors, I mean, a lot of us, you know, we really got introduced to ministry and a love for preaching and stuff like that, you know, through Acts 29 guys like Mark Driscoll, Matt Chandler, all that kind of stuff. And so I don't think it matters like what network we might be part of now. I think we all owe quite a bit to Acts 29. And even during the time that I was in Seattle there as a church planter, of course, I had Mars Hill just right down the road from me. And even though I was with Calvary Chapel, we appreciated a lot of what Acts 29 was doing and got a lot of real, you know, just good input and lessons that we learned from them. Now, you did bring up something that was interesting, just kind of how it's like after, you know, you say you guys have kind of won. It's like you're at that point where like rural ministry, it's seen as a real thing, an important thing. People aren't raising their eyebrows about it. Did you see kind of early on, is it being kind of hard for, you know, more the urban centered focused people to give any sort of honor then to the rural guys?
Yep, for sure. It was hard. And I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I'm a rural guy. Like, I've been on staff at a big church, but like trying to influence, and my role was global. So I was trying to influence our global network to make rural ministry. And God in his spirit is kind. Like, he uses our weakness and empowers it. And he did far more than we could ever. I mean, we didn't have a master strategy that we carried out that won. That I would say that the Lord wanted rural ministry to have an honored place, not a more important, but certainly not less important. And so we had four goals when we set. Well, I say we set out. We came up with four goals: to dignify rural planting, to disciple future and present rural planters, to deliver content relevant to rural settings. We actually had a podcast for a while called Gospel Nobodies. I think you can still find clips of that. It was pretty much interviewing rural guys. And the fourth D, you can tell I was raised as a Baptist. It all is alliterating here. The last one was to develop strategies that would support ongoing rural ministry. And one of those strategies was something came out of the Gospel Coalition of New England. We started something years ago called the Small Town Summits. In fact, I'll be speaking at one tomorrow in Massachusetts. But they were meant to be one-day conferences for rural pastors. We took that idea and went global with it and said, let's do one-day conferences for rural guys. We called them Acts 29 Summits. And that was one of the strategies we developed. But those four Ds, dignify, disciple, deliver, and develop, those were our strategies. And so, like, I even though I say we've won and there's not a need as much for, like, if we are a big mass, like, I've got friends in the Southern Baptist and they seem to have more money than God. But, you know, like, we could have a whole department of rural ministry. We're a small, like, ragtag bunch. So we don't have a department of rural ministry, but we have now in most of our region. So in the United States, well, we have 15 sub-regions. And I would say in most of those, there are both, there are rural planters, there are guys that would be happy to help onboard rural guys who are considering rural planting. And there's kind of support within structurally. So, like, assessments, which is one of Acts 29's strengths, the assessment team is aware if a guy is approaching Acts 29 from a rural setting, we need to make sure that part of the assessment team has a rural assessing pastor on board. So, yeah, all of that, I think, is... I can't beat our chest and say, well, look what we've done, because we are jars of clay. But God has certainly honored that. And that, you know, that's I have a whole theology for why that's important.
Yeah, for sure. Well, honestly, you know, kind of one of your D's there that really stood out to me is your whole thing about, you know, dignify. We want to dignify rural ministry, because it, you know, you read any books, any articles, and any podcast of rural ministries, and there's kind of this theme that is repeated over and over again. And it's the whole idea of the forgotten church. I like rural ministry on the large scale of, you know, evangelism and church planting and church revitalization and just networks. It's like, generally it's not thought of, even though the majority of churches, like, in the United States are actually in rural and small town churches. I mean, it's a huge mission field. There's all these pastors and workers out there, but oftentimes it just gets overlooked. What would you say? Now, here's a question, like, because that is something that is really big on my heart, especially within the Calvary Global Network that I'm in. Because when I was first kind of talking to some of the leadership guys, like Brian Broderson and stuff, in some, like, connect meetings about, you know, what are you guys doing for rural ministry? I mean, I appreciated him. He was really honest. He's like, you know, honestly, Calvary Chapel has generally always been an urban and a suburban church movement, and we really just haven't put a lot of thought into doing small town rural places. You know, what was some of the work you did to kind of get it just on the radar for people, to help them just totally see, hey, this is important and we need to care?
Yeah. And Jack, the best place to get that right was what does the Bible say about rural ministry? So I came up with a pretty robust, not robust, that'd be unfair. I'm a C student. So that would, no. Just really strong arguments for rural ministry. For instance, so the passage that says that may the knowledge of the glory of the Lord cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. Well, that actually means that the glory of the gospel of Jesus is meant to be in every place there are people. Mm-hmm. And so if you start with that broad background going, oh, that the knowledge of the glory of the Lord is meant to cover every part of the earth where there are people, then every little place matters. Then just use the model of Jesus. Like, we love to talk about Paul and the cities, and that's really important. And city to city, I mean, Tim Keller has been one of my heroes since day one. But he's wrong in the sense that, we need village to village in as much as we need city to city. It's not that cities are less important. They're not more important, though. And Jesus himself did not go to the three largest cities of his day. He didn't go to Rome, Alexandria, Egypt, or Ephesus. I think those are the three largest cities of his day. He never visited mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. The Son of God, the only big city he really went to was Jerusalem, which was not a massive city. But he didn't, like, that wasn't a primary, like, so I like to say, listen, if God's called to be like Paul, then be like Paul. But if he's called to be like Jesus, be like Jesus. Like, that's not a downgrade. Mm-hmm. A third good argument is that the darkness in rural places is just as dark as the darkness in cities. And we talk mm-hmm. about cities and all the crime and all that stuff. But man, we had one of the guys that came to Christ here in 2018 was the drug dealer for a town of 4,000, mm-hmm. And the darkness. And I like to point to the story of the demoniac, a guy who was stuck in the grip of Satan in a rural place. And mm-hmm. Jesus went to him and used him to spread the gospel to the small cities there of what, the 10 cities of Decapolis or something like that. Anyway, mm-hmm. That would be a third biblical argument. The fourth would just be kind of it's more descriptive, not prescriptive, but like Philip the evangelist was having great success in the cities of Samaria. And it said the Holy Spirit led him out to a deserted place. And that story in and of itself, while not prescriptive of everyone, is that the Holy Spirit is calling people to isolated places to see people brought to Christ. And there's a danger to that story because people go, and yeah, because that Ethiopian probably was one of the leaders of the Ethiopian church. And so often people think, well, you never know who will come to Christ in a rural place because they might change the world. People like to talk about Billy Graham that way. Mm-hmm. That's fine. That may be true. But if a single mom of three kids who lives in a government subsidized house in a rural community comes to Christ and she faithfully becomes a part of that church, she's just as valuable to the kingdom as a Billy Graham. The last, and this is number five, and to me, this is the big one. On the day of judgment, in Matthew 24, 25, 26, somewhere in there, is the sheep and the goats. Mm-hmm. It says that the Son of Man gathered all the angels and all the nations. So the largest gathering of created beings ever. And then what does he put on display? The first thing he starts talking about there says, when I was in prison, you visited me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. And from that, that to me is the most fascinating and most powerful. Like when God had has the opportunity to put on display what has his first attention, not only attention, but what he honors first is the most obscure act done for his glory. So to extrapolate that into rural ministry, if a glass of water offered to a child brings glory to Christ, and he points that out, that heaven's going to flip the script. I mean, we see these big churches, and God bless them all. I'm glad. You know, the first church ever planted in Jerusalem was 10,000 people. Great. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we need the mega churches to do what they're doing. But my goodness, heaven's going to tell a different story, because the line is going to begin. The first place of honor will be the first attention of heaven when all the angels and all the nations are gathered. Are the most obscure acts done for the name of Jesus, including pastoring and planting in small places. Mm-hmm. That for me is almost, I mean, it's irrefutable. Of when God calls you to a rural place, rejoice, be confident, and serve with absolute confidence that Jesus will be honored there and you will be honored for your service there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, that's a good word. I mean, if there's one thing I've seen rural pastors get discouraged by over and over again, is feeling like, are we accomplishing anything? Does it matter ultimately to the kingdom? And just that reminder of, hey, we don't, our metrics for judging success are so broken in the church. I mean, you look at it, like, I can't remember what the statistic is off the top of my head, but it is something like just the vast majority of churches in the United States are 100 people or less. It's like 75% of churches. I mean, it's just a crazy number. You know, that is a majority of churches. And that means that is where the majority of preaching and discipleship and evangelism and growing people in the Lord is being done, is in these small places. And we're so focused on, we got to fill giant auditoriums. We got to fill with thousands and stuff. And it's funny, like, I just had a friend of mine down from Leavenworth, Kansas. He just planted a church up there a couple years ago. And for a church plant, it's going great. You know, it's about, I don't know, almost 150 people, 130, 150 people, something like that. Great guy. He's got a great heart and attitude. But it's funny, when we're talking about church and stuff, I told him, it's like, hey, you know, my church, we run about 50 to 60 people on a Sunday morning. And when you consider the population of the two towns, I'm actually bringing in about 10% of the population. You know, I mean, think about that. When it comes to influence, it's not a lot of people, but that's a lot of influence that it is having in our community and around us. And you think about mega churches that are in cities of millions of people. Well, you get 10,000 people. Well, what's that, you know, in a city of millions? And I think just people kind of forget about that. You know, it's not about having thousands and thousands of people, but it's about being faithful to just have an influence wherever God has put you. And let me ask you a question then. You know, when it comes to rural ministry, I mean, you already kind of touched on it. You touched on things like drug abuse and, you know, those kinds of problems that we got going on. You know, what do you find is unique to doing ministry in a rural context, you know, that might be surprising to some people?
So there's negative and positive, right? So the negative is isolation, lack of resources. You live in a fishbowl. So those are some of the negative ones. Like we're trying to plant a church here in New Hampshire in a town of 5,000, has no evangelical church in it. And about 20 years ago, there was a church plant attempt, and it kind of left a bad taste in the mouth of that church, that town.
Yeah.
And we want to be diligent and do it right. And because in a small town, you're in a fishbowl and everybody sees it. So that and that means your life as well. Like, it's hard to date your wife in a small town, because you go to the local diner, the only one there, and everybody knows you and you can't have a conversation. So, in fact, a real friend of mine in Kansas talks about driving an hour and a half to go to a place when he and his wife are on a date, just so they have a measure of anonymity. Mm-hmm. Lack of resources. A buddy of mine pastors a church down in Brady, Texas, and the one gym in town was closing, and he and his wife used it. And so, because it's the only option, like, they actually bought it and reopened it for the sake of serving the community. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of, like, we can be resource poor, and that mm-hmm. means, you know, people. And then the isolation, like, it's not easy to get together with a cup of coffee with a buddy in the faith, you know, and pastoral fraternity, having a brotherhood of pastors is, I think, essential for sanity. In fact, well, I'd make that an argument for longevity in ministry. So those are challenges, right? Those are challenges. Mm-hmm. And then even the sense of, like, if you're in a denomination or network or whatever, there's not as much dignity given to that role. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so those are some of the downsides. Some of the upsides, it's a great place to live. Like, mm-hmm. rural life is absolutely awesome. A great place to raise family. It's a great place to have an influence. You already mentioned this. Like, a little church in a little town can have a vast more percentage-wise influence than a church, even a bigger church in a city. And so I think those are some of the positives to mm-hmm. it. I think as a pastor, you have a more prominent role in a small town. I don't mean that in an arrogant way. I mean that in a ministry way, a Jesus honoring
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Like, everybody knows the pastor in town.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, kind of like you were talking about having some friends, like, when they want to go on a date night or anything, they got to go like an hour and a half away. I mean, just this last week when I had my, you know, buddy down from Leavenworth, Kansas and stuff, we were having breakfast at a local restaurant. I can't tell you how many people came walking up to me while we were just eating our breakfast, and I ended up having ministry time with them. just because they all know me. I mean, everybody in town knows me. They recognize me. And, you know, they're just sharing with me about deaths in the family, you know, adoptions of nieces and nephews that are about to happen and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, it's true. I mean, it's like when you're a small town pastor, everywhere you go, you got to be ready to do ministry because everybody knows who you are and everybody knows you as a pastor, you know? And so,
And so there are pros and there are cons. The issue of it really is though, being confident of your calling and content with your calling, that in that calling you are pleasing Christ, and on the day that everything's wrapped up, you will be honored for that. You're not going to be compared to the big city guys, or there's just none of that. So there's a lot of pros. There's some downsides to it, but I mean, for those of us in it, most rural guys I know love the context, love the positives. And part of my role has been able to champion that and applaud that and give a voice to it. And again, I use the word dignify, but like, man, it's a noble calling to be obedient to Jesus and go to a place nobody knows.
What do you think are some of the specific ministry things that people in rural communities find themselves doing that might be surprising to people outside of rural communities?
Oh my. I mean, there are opportunities to serve that maybe don't seem to make sense to larger settings. There is a personal level. And I think, Jack, what struck me in my first church, because it was a little village setting, what were the amount of weddings and funerals I got to ask of people I did not know, because, you know, in that particular town, there was a Methodist church, there's a Baptist church. And like typically a relative would say, hey, I know Pastor Dave down there, and you should go talk to him. And so the opportunities for the gospel were incredible that way. I think as the church, there are ways that you can serve a community. I'll swing back to my buddy in Brady, Texas. They have so impacted that town. They adopted, they came up with another 501c3 to actually rehab dilapidated homes and help provide them for the poor. They've just won over so many people by that. They are quite a gifted couple, but they started a business that blesses the community. And so I think they're just, unending ways the Holy Spirit might use the church. I'm talking pastor's context. I'm not actually, you know, I'm trying to think of right now a rural church that has a unique ministry in a community that would be, one's not coming to mind immediately, but I just think that the creativity of the Holy Spirit opens up all sorts of doors. Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I can say definitely in the time that I've been here, you know, we got a little small church. It's a little small Southern Baptist church up from ours. And one of the cool things they started doing that has had a huge impact, and it's kind of sad because I keep hearing about them getting pushback from some of the older congregants now, is they started doing food drives and stuff like that every Friday. You know, they got a truck, they got a big box truck, they get in all sorts of food. I can't remember from what organization, but it's up in Kansas City, which is about an hour and a half away from us. They bring it down and they'll supply about 300 families with groceries, you know, which is huge. I mean, and that's awesome. And I just cheer them on in what they're doing. And of course, that is having a huge impact in drawing in a lot of the poor people in our areas. I mean, our county that I live in here in St. Clair County is one of the poorest counties in all of Missouri. It's not the poorest, but it's like in the top, you know, 10 poorest counties in Missouri. And so it's just been awesome seeing the way that a lot of people have been coming and getting drawn into their church, and they're having a lot of growth, and it's super exciting. But with that also kind of comes some pushback, you know, because one thing about rural ministry as well is people are pretty set in their ways. And we always kind of joke about the old curmudgeon in his pew getting mad when he gets to church and somebody is sitting in his seat. But that's kind of the reality of some of the cultural things that we face in rural areas is lots of people, like, because a lot of churches are small and they stay small for a long time. If suddenly they get some sudden growth, they can start getting pushback. Even pastors can start getting pushback because now, hey, evangelism happening, people are getting saved. You kind of mentioned that a little bit too, you know, before we started this recording here, that when you took on the church you were at and there was revitalization and growing happening here, a lot of the original congregants got pretty upset with you about that.
Yeah, so, I would lost five key families in the course of 3 years, and I thought I almost quit ministry. That would have been 1994. Mm-hmm. And but a part of it was just, and this is an opportunity for discipleship. So I'm in a church planting network, but if you're revitalizing a church and trying to lead an old church into being on mission, the analogy that works well for me, Jack, is often the church sees itself as a cruise ship with all the amenities and comfort for the passengers on board on its journey to paradise, when in reality, we're much more like a Coast Guard cutter with a lot of the same systems and structures of a cruise ship, but we have a different mission. We're trying to rescue people from death and make them into crew members. Mm-hmm. And that means that takes away some of the comfort thinking. And it also says, well, what's necessary for this, for the rescuing of those who are dying versus, you know, the first church I pastored, just was there a couple of weeks ago for its 200th anniversary. It was planted in 1823.
Wow.
And so I was there, and the three living pastors, we were all there. I pastored there from 87 to 97. And, it, you know, just some of the changes that we did as far as like renovating the old sanctuary is beautiful, but like simplifying it. The old organ is gone. Organ was a great gift to the 18th century church or the 19th century church.
Yeah.
But it has, like, my adult children would have, it would not help them worship at all. So mm-hmm. like it is a challenge, but if it's an opportunity to disciple, mm-hmm. if they love Jesus, you can call them to say, listen, are we here for ourselves or for the people who aren't in this building?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and you emphasize discipleship, you know, again, there as being like one of your big things, you know, with rural ministry, you wanted to dignify and you wanted to disciple. What do you see, you know, especially to kind of encourage pastors, because discipleship in a small area can be, in small towns, a small church, it can be pretty difficult, you know, because you think about larger churches, they tend to have like even sometimes just schools of discipleship, you know, for training up their people. Whereas, you know, I'll be honest with you, kind of in rural communities, you suddenly say, hey, we're going to do a school of whatever you guys want to join. A lot of people are kind of like, no, not really. Thanks, pastor. You know, what does discipleship look like, you know, for pastors in small rural areas?
And Jack, that's a really good question. So again, in the church planning context, if a guy's going to a rural place, there are four systems I think they need to be thinking about ahead of time. One is just a financial system. Yeah. Like and that's true of a church plant or an existing church. And another is like how to raise up future elders. Okay. So we believe in the plurality of elders. I think my only personal experience, that's part of been my sanity just over the years, that it doesn't weigh on me as a solo elder. And that's tough in a small church, but like, what does that look like? What does discipleship look like? What kind of system do you have for there? And then now this may sound kind of, it's probably a little less relevant here, but the system of assimilation, like if new people show up, do you have a plan? So, but back to the raising up elders under that. So under mm-hmm. that would be, I think there are three groups. Well, let's say three groups to disciple. One would be leaders in general. Mm-hmm. And with the goal of you're trying to, and that can be subdivided, but with us, it's been, and we would do it every other year, a 10-month mm-hmm. training, once a month for 3 hours with homework. We would open to every guy in the church. We want every guy to go through this. We call it men in training, because we want every guy to aspire to be an elder, which they may or may not want to, but the course was a discipling course. Mm-hmm. We did the alternate years we did with women. We did a women's leadership training. Now, I come from a tradition where we're complementarians. So we don't have women elders, but we have women deacons. Mm-hmm. We have women mm-hmm. serving at all sorts of capacities. And to do that for my role was significant. And I learned this from another Acts 29 pastor about, like, by being in the room with these sisters, again, at 10 months, we did the same sort of structure. Content was a little different. And then I think, but you could combine that in a small church into like a leadership plan. I mm-hmm. think once a month for us, the sweet spot was meeting Sundays from 1 to 3. That worked really well. We didn't have a Sunday night service. We rented space. We didn't have opportunity to do it before service, but it was a sweet spot for us. And that has produced incredible results. And then just general discipling. And sometimes that's going to be like, I used to do with young men, just mm-hmm. young single men, unique crew. We also use Dave Ramsey stuff. What is that called?
Financial Peace University, that stuff.
Yeah, so adopting a plan for like, how are we going to mature people, whether it be finances, whether it be young men, whether it be theology. Mm-hmm. And so I think adapting that to a rural setting, so you don't set your expectations up too high and get discouraged, you know, so you don't have a school of discipleship, but you could have every other year, we're going to do a men's training thing. And part of that is we're looking to produce elders, but we want all men to go through it. Mm-hmm. The alternate years, we could do a women's leadership training where we want all women to go through this. And the pastor wants to be engaged with that, because one of the dangers, I think, with women's ministry, especially for my tribe with complementarian, is we just outsource it rather than being engaged in it. Mm-hmm. And man, I've learned more from those sisters. It's been incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And then a general discipling. I think, though, this one of the most significant things is what happens when someone becomes a convert. What's mm-hmm. your plan to walk with him for the next 3 to 4 years? And even if it's just like, okay, this year we want to do this year. I think even small churches need to think about that, because God may or may not give you a convert, but he may give you more if you're prepared for them. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So yeah. I think you're just adapting it and making it reasonable for a small church, and giving yourself time. Like you don't have to, like, one thing about rural people, if you know, growing things takes time. Like mm-hmm. we're agricultural people, and we can just, like, God is not in a hurry. Like, Jesus hasn't come back. He said, I'm coming back. He hasn't come back. Like, God is not like anxious that we get stuff done quickly. Mm-hmm. Last thing I'll say on that is that if the Son of Man took 30 years just to sit on this earth and build stuff as a carpenter, and like, he didn't do anything more than that, the Son of Man, the eternal, for whom the whole universe was made, then we can take some time mm-hmm. to plan things out and just a steady approach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you bringing on that whole taking time and being patient, I was just thinking about that as you were describing kind of your ministry plan, like with the men. Hey, you know, for a year, we'll focus on the men, meet once a month, you know, about 3 hours, do this thing, you know, next year we'll do the women. And, you know, that right there is something that I think a lot of people, especially who come into rural areas, don't even consider, because the turnover rate of pastors, like in rural churches, I remember when reading Tom Rainier's book, Autopsy of a Deceased Church, especially in smaller rural areas, it was like 3 to 5 years was like how long an average pastor stayed at a place. And I have seen the negative side effects of that. Like, the church I'm pastoring now, I've been here for about 9.5 years. I took it over in 2014. Before me, between 2020 and 2014, there were 1, 2, 3, 4 pastors. Like, I was the fifth pastor coming into the church. And I would like to say that was a rare thing for the churches in the area, but that was actually true of a lot of the churches in the area. They just continually cycled through. And because of that, a lot of that long-term discipleship you were talking about that needed to be happening to raise up real good biblical leaders didn't happen, because the pastors weren't there long enough to really set a standard and a tone for what discipleship looks like and to carry people all the way through it.
Yeah. And you really touched on an incredible thing. Like, I think guys called to rural ministry need to look at it for the long haul and mm-hmm. not be looking at my joke. You know, people talk about grass being greener on the other side of the fence. Well, that's just because there's a septic leak. It's not, it's not because it's better, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mentioned that church that I first pastored. So it had that same history for so long. My mm-hmm. dad was the first guy to break that. He was there for 12 years. I was there for 10 years. The next pastor was for 13 years. The present pastor has been there 10 years. And that church, I think, has been revitalized mm-hmm. because of the longevity of the last four pastors. Prior to that, it was 2, 3, 4 years, 2, 3, 4 years, something like that. Yeah. Yep. That's you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm because, like, I am here in about About the end of this year, I think I will be the longest pastor this church has ever had. And the church that I pastored, Park Grove Christian Church, was established in 1866. I mean, it's been going a long time, kind of like the one you described that you pastored at. I mean, we're talking about, as far as the United States goes, these are old churches, you know, and yet a lot of them have this long history of pastoral turnover, which that kind of touches on something too, kind of bringing in the whole network side of it. What benefits can networks really give and bring in to help encourage pastors to stay, you know, to keep going, to not give up, to not get burned out, especially those in rural areas? When I moved here, I had a, I'm really relational. I'm very multi-denominational. Like, I don't care, you know, as long as we got the essentials down, I'll be your buddy. We'll go get coffee, you know, and we can debate theology if we want to, but, like, you know, let's just focus on encouraging one another. I used to get breakfast with five different pastors every Tuesday morning. Now, a number of those guys aren't even in the ministry anymore, and not a single one of them is pastoring the church that they were pastoring when I got here.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, the whole purpose of this thing was to kind of help encourage and to not burn, you know, not get burned out and to help us stay the course, you know, but even just over time we faced church splits. You know, I dealt with one, something kind of like that, you know, a few years ago, about 5 years ago. Other guys just got run out of their churches for trying to change stuff too much. How have you seen, especially in your role, what have you seen is the most beneficial thing that networks can do to help strengthen and to support and encourage pastors, you know, when they do start struggling, they start thinking, man, this ain't worth it. I'm about to just, you know, parachute out of here.
Yeah. The brotherhood for me is huge. That, when we first planted in 2002, and our network was small back then. And then within a couple of years, there were three of us in New England, and we would get together every 8 weeks, about an hour drive for each of us. One guy was in Boston, one was up in Portland, Maine, and I'm here in Concord, New Hampshire. We'd get together in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and just commiserate and encourage each other. And you could talk freely. Mm-hmm. And I think the network provides a place for security, but it also provides a place for sort of let's just call it professional development, because guys can challenge each other. And especially, so the difference between, to me, a denomination, which is covering a lot of things, versus a network like ours, is we're really a one-trick pony, in a sense. What we're trying to plant more churches, which calls people to the mission, which calls churches to not just evangelize, plant a church, you know, plant a church, but plant other churches. And in that setting, there's just a lot of creativity, a lot of counsel, a lot of pushback. Like, you know, if Acts 29 has a history of some real bad scenarios that aren't.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, people say, oh, how do you feel about that? I said, well, read the New Testament, read the Old Testament. Like,
that's church history. That's
the
just
story
all
of Jesus, and the story of God is he works with all sorts of broken units. And, you know, I can mention one of our founders being Mark Driscoll, and the good he did is still good. Like, in other words, I couldn't agree with him on a lot of stuff today on his practice and ecclesiology and that stuff, but, like, the good he did was good. And part of the network for me has been this brotherhood, that not just to sort of sit and whine, that's not it at all, but to learn, to be sharpened both in theology and creative in mission, because it takes ingenuity. That idea I spoke earlier of discipling men and women with a 2 year back and forth. I learned that from an Acts 29 church. And so there's just opportunity to grow and support one another, like when there's a real need. I think denominations can do that as well. And certainly the bigger the denomination, like Southern Baptist, they have just so many things going for them. And if that's where you're at, that's fine and good. But for a lot of us, I think, at least in my circles, the deep brotherhoods, we're on the same sort of theological sandbox. So you don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. By the way, I want to applaud you for getting together with those other pastors, because for 40 years now, there's a pastors group here in Concord that gets together every 2 weeks from all sorts of denominations, broadly evangelical. But it's just for fellowship and pray, and it has raised the level of trust and brotherhood. And when guys come and go, when churches how new pastors, the new guys are welcomed in, the old guys are celebrated as they leave. Mm-hmm. But there's just a real consistency there because we are part of the broad church of Jesus. Mm-hmm. I couldn't run with those guys on a lot of things, but so I think that's important. But the idea that I have a brotherhood that we don't have to worry about, we understand each other's theology, we're on this mission, we're in a sort of a high commitment network where we're leading our churches to invest 10% of our gross receipts into church planting. That's mm-hmm. that's a challenge in and of itself. But for me, it becomes like it's kept me sane. That's really, and then it's challenged me to grow mm-hmm. both in leadership, but also in holiness. And so I think whatever network that looks like for you, mm-hmm. we all need that. And a rural guy needs it as much as anyone. Like a city guy, he can find more pastors around easily mm-hmm. than rural guys, but making that a regular rhythm is super significant. I just came back. I think it's biannual every other year now, but we have our pastor's wives retreat and just came back from that. There are 570 people there. And when you get in a room of people who are fighting the same fight and the retreat was really like, there were some the morning sessions, but the rest of it was all free at time and the time together and the brotherhood and sisterhood and just all of that. It's just like, it's like a shot of like, I'm not in this alone. People understand the struggles. And we have a pastor's care crew. We have wives support. So we have, and these are small, but they are in meaningful ways of supporting people where they are. But the idea that we're not in this alone is really, really important.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can say that's absolutely huge because even after kind of that little group I was with kind of disintegrated, I've been able to find a few more guys to kind of start connecting back with. And I mean, as you know, as a guy who's in the ministry, and of course, anybody who's going to listen to this podcast, I'm going to assume it's probably going to be guys in the ministry. You know, there's a lot of struggles that we have that a lot of people just don't understand. And there's unique struggles in rural ministry that, like, when I talk to a lot of my friends in urban ministry and stuff like that, I mean, you know, I got good friends who are high up, you know, like within Calvary Chapel and stuff like that. And just sometimes when I start talking to them about stuff and they'll just start discussing things like, yeah, well, you know, this is where you really got to depend on your staff and you got to really push into your, and you're just like, okay, we're in a completely different world here. Like that doesn't even exist, you know, where I'm at, you know? And so, yeah, that is so key and so important. Now, one of the things you have brought up and you've kind of thrown them all together is the idea of church planting and revitalization and taking over existing works, you know, within Acts 29. So you guys put a huge emphasis on doing church planting, which is something I've always appreciated about Acts 29. You want to get new churches planted. What are some of the challenges that you have seen, especially in rural areas, when it comes to getting a new work established, a new church planted? And when would you say it sometimes would be better that instead of planting a church, to go into an existing church and revitalize it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think revitalizing an existing church might be a preference. The trouble is that existing church having done it, so my first 10 years of doing it, even though they may say they want it, mm-hmm. what you start to challenge are, we might call them the sacred cows, or just like idolatry, like simple things like worship style or dress or the color of the sanctuary or pulling out the pews and putting in chairs, or, you know, things that are irrelevant to eternity, mm-hmm. but can help on the mission. So, you know, if you can revitalize a church, I think in one sense, that's especially in a rural setting, that you already have a place to meet. You already have a core group. Mm-hmm. That leads you. So that's the hard thing of rural planting is resourcing mm-hmm. money. Like, how are you going to provide for a family? How are you going to build a core out of nothing? And where are you going to meet? And is this some of the things that you don't have to think about with revitalization? They both have their challenges. The upside of with a plant is you're not dealing with, you know, 200 years of history, and you're not dealing with entrenched either formal or informal leaders who may not be godly mm-hmm. Or mature. I don't have a preference. I work for a church planting network. Mm-hmm. And I you know, that's where I put my limited time, but my first church was a revitalization, and I think it's a legit. So I wouldn't say there's a if you're called to a rural plant, like we have two guys in our church, Bethlehem Seminary grads who've come mm-hmm. to join us to help plant a church in a neighboring town. And they've been here 3 years, and their core is up to 9 committed adults in 3 mm-hmm. years. They're still part of our church. We haven't sent them out. We figure we need 20 to 25 adults before we can launch them.
Yeah.
And it's a town that has zero evangelical churches. So there's not even a church to revitalize.
Wow.
And it has a small college on camp in that town of 1,000 students, no Christian mm-hmm. ministry. And this is New England. It's sort of that sort of norm. But I say that to say that God, they have matured, these two young men have matured in finding, one is now a biology professor, a professor teacher at the local high school in where they plan to plant. Mm-hmm. The other is he's bivocational. We have raised money to support him. But he also teaches phys ed in a charter school.
Okay.
And I think those sorts of challenges are, that's where a denomination can be helpful. But it's just going to take time. And so either one's going to, you're not going to revitalize the church quickly. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I'm not, I I'm in a church planning network. I think that's what I think about. But mm-hmm. I'm certainly not opposed to revitalization. Now, I have a personal opinion that a lot of revitalization should actually be replants.
Yeah.
Where you shut down the existing church, you dispense of the old way of doing things, you basically suspend the Constitution, and you allow the young leaders to reform it mm-hmm. in a new way. Obviously, the old timers, the faithful people that are part of it, have to agree to shut it down.
Yeah.
And that only happens, I would say, in probably 5 to 10% of the conversations that we have. But that's happening. And even talking about it through this podcast, I hope maybe it could land on some people going, yeah, we need to talk about that, or we need to talk to that church about that, because these old churches aren't getting younger.
No, they're definitely not. And that's interesting, because I've heard Mark Clifton, of course, in his podcast, Revitalize and Replant, kind of talk about those kinds of things as well. Now, when you're talking about doing like a replant like that, and you're talking about shut down, would you say it would be like smart for like, hey, church, we're just going to shut down and we're just going to disband? Like, we're not going to meet for like a couple months and then we're coming back together? Because I've heard of some churches, kind of going that far, so that it's like, hey, when we meet back together, it's really kind of a fresh start. Or do you see it kind of like just kind of like all the leaders and everybody's got to get together and we just kind of got to say, hey, we're throwing everything away and we're just rewriting the playbook and starting from scratch? Like,
yeah,
what do you kind of see?
I think both could work. I think the new leadership, like if you have a young guy God has called and he feels called to this community, he's been in conversation with his church about replanting, and he brings his a posse with him of, another two or three couples.
Mm-hmm.
I think in that setting, the shutting down completely, disbanding with the intention, but meeting as small groups.
Yeah.
Where
the
new leaders able to develop new DNA, new values. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about changing doctrine. We're just talking about what is.
Yeah.
Like, and then relaunching. I think that time gap is probably a healthier trend.
Mm-hmm.
But like in my case, we just took a 3-year, it was a 3-year slow change, just about killed me. And, let me say this, the number one scar I think pastors bear is the scars of betrayal and abandonment.
Yes.
Whether it
Amen.
Be converts or leaders or just members. And it can be both intentional and aggressive or unintentional, like just people moving away, but you feel abandoned. And the only answer to that is just forgive those who sinned against you mm-hmm. and trust God. So I talk about having thick skin and a soft heart, that mm-hmm. that the thick skin is, this is just part of the brutality of war.
Mm-hmm.
Paul told Timothy, you gotta be a soldier. This is just part of the scarring of war. The soft heart allows you not to get bitter and resentful. And mm-hmm. so you have to keep forgiving people, even as their thoughts come back up about them. And, and that keeps your heart soft. I think forgiveness is a huge antidote to that. With that said, back to the topic you'd raised, I'm not sure which one's better, although mm-hmm. in our context, talking about a replant, the time gap, we just had, our church has had a conversation with the church, and they didn't that is dwindled down to 20 people, and they've got a building that's about 15 miles from here. And we were willing to adopt them, but we wanted them to shut down, join us, drive the extra distance for, we didn't set a time frame, but for a relaunch. And they just couldn't go for it. Now they're talking to another church who say, no, we'll take what you have and keep it going, and we will bring our values to it. Is that wrong? No. I think what we were asking was a high bar. And for our setting, that's the only thing we could ask. The other church they're not a church plant. They're a little more, I just want to be careful on the terms. They just have a different DNA and their approach. So I hope they're able to revitalize that church. It won't be a replant. We would have done a replant, rebranding, retitling, renaming, all that stuff. But
Well, and I think I like just kind of what you're touching on there. It's like the reality is when it comes to churches, and this is true urban or rural. I mean, this is just kind of across the board. It's like there isn't necessarily like a one size fits all and it always works. I mean, there's lots of different ways of going about it. Now, what are some encouragements you would give to people then who are just going in and they're just going to plant a church in a rural area? You know, you already brought up, you got two guys right now. You know, they're both already plugging into their communities, you know, as teachers, and they're starting to build their core. You said you prefer about a core of about 25 people. How do you guys encourage your church planters then to get that core of people? What do you expect that core of people to commit to as well when they're going out with that church planter? And what would you encourage that church planter to do in preparing his core?
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother podcast. But
yeah, I know that's a huge one. Yeah,
it is. We don't pray enough for workers. The harvest is great. The workers are due. Pray occasionally for workers. No, it says pray earnestly for workers.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we do that enough. Number two, you have to then establish a DNA. And so these two guys have their, we have home groups or what we call community groups in our church. Well, their community group is specific to planting a church.
Yeah.
And so they are building into it. What does it mean to be on mission? What does it mean to have gospel conversations? What does it mean to endure over the long haul? And so I think the way you shape that core takes time. You just can't take, like when I planted, we took anybody who would raise their hand and say, I'm a Christian.
Yeah.
Well, that was both good and bad. Like you could build a core quicker, but it wasn't as enduring. And it was fraught with some issues right from the get-go.
Yeah, I've personally seen that. I've been through it. I know what you mean. Yep.
Yeah, so I just think you have to give yourself time and rest in the calling and see how God, I mean, your first calling is, how do I provide for my family? How do I have rhythms of rest and health? Am I part, am I connected to a healthy church? One of the concerns I have is when guys parachute in and they're not connected to a nearby church is that they can get like desperate and they can launch too soon. And, you know, if you launch too soon, you start with 12 people and you try to do a regular weekly service of 12 people and they're the committed ones. And so there's illness, there's travel and all that. And God doesn't add to that number quickly. It soon becomes evident that this plant isn't going to last. And that's why having what we would call critical mass, and that can vary, but, 20 to 25 people to me is like minimum. That's minimum. I mean, ideally, it's more than that, but it's minimum.
Yeah. And what would you say, like, you know, for the church plants you've seen in the rural area? I mean, that I know this could be answered in a lot of different ways. You know, what is a key to success, and what is almost like it's just a, you know, it's going to fail. You know, you brought up like the guys parachuting in, they only got 12 people and not going, you know, what are some of the key things that you're looking for that when you're like encouraging church planters, you're saying, hey, that's good. Keep working on that. That's going to be successful. We've seen it over and over again. And then with other people, you're just like, hey, you guys got to pull back on stuff here and really do some reconsidering. What are some of those other key things also?
Wow. Well, keeping it simple, having a good coach. Here's a really important thing to have. You have to be okay to fail. Like you have not failed Jesus if in this being obedient to plant a church, it doesn't work. He doesn't love you less. You have not failed. Your mother still loves you. You know, like, so like, I don't know if that's answering your question.
No. I mean, I can tell you from my own personal experience doing revitalization, there's an important aspect to that, because so many pastors, whether they're doing a revitalization or a church plant, if they don't go in with the attitude of, hey, I am doing this in service to Jesus, my relationship with him is based on his grace given to me freely, not in my success as a planter, you're able to endure a lot more. But when you base your sense of worth and value and relationship with God off of the success of your ministry, that kills guys. I mean, I've seen that kill, yeah. That almost killed me, literally. I mean, it like almost brought me down a long time ago. So that's an important, very key thing.
And this is probably going to be the most important thing for me to say, is that the pastor has to see himself as a model missionary who has friends with sinners. It dawned on me after we planted that I was raised in a pastor's home. I went to a Christian school. I went to a Christian college. Mm-hmm. I got a Christian job. I went to Christian seminary. I got a Christian wife. Like I lived a Christian world. And I realized, it became evident after we planted a couple years in, I didn't have anybody who would say, Dave Pinckney is one of my good friends. Mm. And that hit me. The conviction was just huge. And so my wife and I talked, and we did a couple things. But first, one thing that we did that has been so successful, in the sense that we joined a local book club. At one point, I think it's 14 now, but there's 17 of us, men and women. Everybody else is either lost or they go to a church but most of them are like not anywhere near being Christian. Devout atheist, socialist. We have devout communists. We have a woman who introduced herself, well, I'm in Wiccan. And this is, I'm going to guess, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that community has allowed me it just has put me in a place where on a regular basis, I'm with people who are far from Christ, and we become fast friends. So my daughter and wife and church threw me a surprise 60th birthday here not too long ago. And who was part of the people showing up? My lost people from my book club. Mm-hmm. And it just did my heart joy. And I think we can't expect, if every member is a missionary,
mm-hmm.
we can't expect the people in our church to be having gospel conversations and loving people over the long haul if we're not doing it ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if Jesus was a friend of sinners, and that's tough for a pastor, because we have it puts us in places where you might not, people are dropping the F-bomb or they're offering you a beer. And like, I'm glad they offer big beer. I'm from New England. I like beer, but like that may not work in your denomination or your conscience. And so the fact of the matter is we can't converse in the gospel with where people are, because while the gospel is a simple message, evangelism often takes a long time. We mm-hmm. have a young man joining our church in a couple of weeks who was in our young men's, we met every other week for five years. He was in it for like 5 years. And then he moved to North Carolina, came to Christ down there. But we planted and watered somebody. He came to Christ down in North Carolina, came back to New Hampshire with his wife, and they're joining our church. But like, that was just an enduring, long season. I just have to be okay with that. And so to me, that's the most important thing, because I think evangelistic missional zeal for the pastor of the church has to be the tip of the spear.
Mm-hmm.
That the church exists in the community to be a light to the community, a friend of sinners, a harbor for those who are lost and searching. And I think the pastor has to model that. So fitting that all in, and a really good day off. Rest is so important. So a day off. And I would argue every pastor should have 4 weeks off, 3 weeks consecutively in the summer. We would find as soon as the kids got out of school, we hit the road, go to the in-laws. We had a camper or a tent or something. And then then a week at holidays. We just need to rest well, because if you don't rest well, you can't work well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, like, that's a whole nother podcast.
I know there's so many questions. I was just like, man, I just want to dive into that more. Let's talk about rest and send it to all of our elders, right? But yeah, well, let me ask you. Okay, I realize I just look at the clock. I've almost had you for an hour already, or a little over an hour. What are some other things, just kind of wrapping up, because I want to honor and respect your time. And I don't know, maybe I'll bring you back on here later and we'll just dive in specifically to one real specific topic. But what are some main things that you would want to leave listeners with, you know, just kind of with this whole idea of just rural ministry and as a network leader and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, immerse yourself in the good theology and thinking of rural ministry. So one of my favorite books is A Big Gospel in Small Places by Stephen Whitmer, good friend of mine. And another one has just recently come out, Pastoring in Small Towns by Ronnie Martin and Donnie Griggs, both good friends of mine. Mm-hmm. These are like, immerse yourself in good thinking and get, you know, assure yourself of God is pleased. If he's called you to a small place, he's pleased with that. And it's not a downgrade. It's not the farm league. It's not the AAA baseball team. It is like, it is where the Son of God, the Lord of glory, has assigned you to make disciples. And in that, you can find rhythms of rest and ways. So I would just, and then, you know, think creatively. Like, if you're pastoring a church of 25, 30 people, you've got some spare time. Maybe you need to have a side gig that fills your tank. You know, maybe there's something that you could do that would bless your community. Maybe mm-hmm. there's a business you need to bring to town. Like, I have heard multiple churches who have gone into a community and said, well, how can we serve this community? And you know, the quintessential one is, well, they need a really good coffee shop. And if that's your thing and you know how to do all that crazy stuff with those expensive machines, then think about that as an option. But yeah. I think you need to look at the theology of it, your calling, and then sustainability. I think mm-hmm. you need to think, how can I stay here for the long haul?
Mm-hmm. Yep. No. That is an awesome, awesome word and really good encouragement there. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate this conversation. I appreciate you kind of bouncing all over, you know, talking about a number of different things in rural ministry. But once again, I'm so excited by what Acts 29 is doing. I'm excited too how you really just saying, like, within Acts 29. I mean, rural ministry is a dignified thing in the eyes of the church. And that is such a huge and encouraging thing to me. And that is my hope and my desire, you know, for our own network with CGN, that we see, you know, reach that same place where we recognize these small towns, backwoods places, that these are places full of people that God loves. And we need to really make a plan with the Lord's help to get in there and to reach and to encourage them with the gospel of Jesus Christ. So, David, thank you so much for coming on, man. I greatly appreciate it.
An honor. Thanks, Jack. Yep. Bye.
This has been an episode of the Country Chapel Podcast, a ministry of Calvary Global Network. Please like and share this with your friends in ministry and subscribe so that you can be notified whenever we release any future content. Mm-hmm.